everyone. Welcome to Selected Essays, a podcast series from The Point magazine about essays you should read but probably haven't. Each episode, we'll be talking with writers about an essay that's influenced one of their own. My name is Jess Swoboda, and I'm here with my co-host, Zach Fine.
Hey, everyone. This week, we spoke with Apoorva Tadapalli about Maeve Brennan's essay, Lost Overtures, which was collected in The Long-Winded Lady, Notes from the New Yorker in 1969, and Apoorva's It's Okay to Talk to Me When I'm Trying to Read, which was published in Electric Literature in 2018. Apoorva is a writer from New York who has served as an assistant editor for Lapham's Quarterly and a fact-checker for The New Republic and Guernica. Her essays have appeared in The Point, The Los Angeles Review of Books, The Atlantic, The Yale Review, The Nation, and The Baffler, among others.
We hope you'll enjoy this episode and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you have questions, comments, or anything else, send an email to selectedessays@thepointmag.com. We'd love to hear from you. And also be sure to subscribe to The Point, the magazine that brings you content like this podcast. You can find a 50% off discount code exclusive to listeners in the episode notes. Hey, Apoorva, thanks so much for joining us on this episode of Selected Essays.
Thank you. So nice to be here.
And so I wondered if we could start by having you tell us a bit about why you like Maeve Brennan and what you find most interesting about her.
Yeah. I came to Maeve Brennan. I kind of discovered her in just literally the classic, like found her in the $1 shelf at the Strand, didn't know who she was, like in my first week of New York. Like it's a very Maeve Brennan story, I think. And like, I just enjoyed like her tone of sort of just wandering around, not really looking for anything in particular, sort of energy. I spent a lot of my first year in New York alone doing sort of the things that she does. And I found her just like a contentment with people watching to be really good company. And I also sort of through like watching her behavior in New York, came to really appreciate like my own company in New York.
And then wondering if you could tell us a bit about her biography.
Yeah. She was born in Dublin in 1917. She grew up there. She came to, I think, Washington, D.C. at the age of 17 when her father got a job. And then she sort of spent the rest of her teen years in North Carolina in like the suburbs. And she came to New York shortly after that working random jobs. She kind of got into Harper's Weekly at a very young age, which was like a sort of women's run magazine. And she started moving in literary circles in New York and then kind of moved to the more male dominated New Yorker. You know, she spent a lot of time with other Irish Americans. She never really had a fixed home in New York. She sort of stayed at friends' houses and in motels.
Out of all of Brennan's essays, you selected Lost Overtures. Can you tell us why this essay and what it's about?
So this is an essay that's just, it's a very short essay that's basically two scenes that take place in two different restaurants. And she just sort of describes people trying to connect with each other and sort of not really succeeding. And I'll read it. But I just thought that the minor tragedy of it was very striking, but also I find her sympathy towards these people who are just seeking sort of companionship that is sort of unplanned. She talks in another essay somewhere about the accidental nature of our lives. Like, she has a sympathy towards these people she's describing who are like seeking some sort of, you know, unplanned companionship with other strangers. And I thought that was very sweet, like the way she looks at these people who are trying to make friends in these restaurants and are kind of not allowed to because it looks sort of unseemly.
Usually we have people read just the first passage of an essay, but could you read the whole thing for us, actually?
I can read both scenes, yes. Yeah, it's a very short essay. Early the other evening, I was sitting in a restaurant on Lower Fifth Avenue that has peach-colored walls and a softly lighted mirror running the length of the bar, when a striking red-haired lady in a black dress with pearls, who was sitting by herself at a table not far from mine, stood up and walked to a corner table where a nice-looking man was sitting alone, reading his evening paper while he waited for someone to come and take his order. He was a careful, orderly man. He had already folded his newspaper up small so that he could read it and at the same time eat his dinner. The lady bent over this man and said something to him, and he glanced up and then got up immediately, looking very pleased and confused, and collected his briefcase and followed her back to her table. He was still clutching his newspaper. She sat down, but at the last moment, when he was almost in his chair, he hesitated and began looking around him and behind him. "Are you sure you're alone?" he asked. "Of course I'm alone," she replied. He sat down and she picked up her drink and started gazing at him possessively. She looked possessive but very good-humored. They were just beginning to talk when the head waiter, a big, dignified man, appeared from a distant corner of the restaurant and saw the change that had been made in his seating arrangements. He walked swiftly to where the lady sat with her flattered captive, who had settled back and seemed about to relax. "Sir," said the head waiter, "please go back to your own table." The man, everything was happening to him, jumped up, gathered his briefcase and his newspaper to his chest, and scurried to his corner table and picked up the menu and held it in front of his cowardly face. The lady was annoyed. "Just who do you think you are?" she said to the head waiter. "Lady," said the head waiter, "do me a favor. Please go home." "Don't talk to me like that," she said. "Who do you think you are? Don't you talk to me like I was dirt." "Lady," said the head waiter, "please don't tell me that I am talking to you like you were dirt." Unfortunately, I'd already paid my check and put on my gloves, and I hadn't the nerve to just sit there watching. So I had to leave without hearing the rest of the repartee. 2 evenings later, I was in the Steak de Paris on West 49th Street. It was peaceful there, a warm, rainy evening. I had worked my way through Time back to front and was starting in on Newsweek when someone came and stood beside me. I looked up and it was a very tall, solemn, scholarly-looking young man who had made a good deal of fuss over his briefcase when he came into the restaurant. He'd given his hat to the checkroom girl, but he had taken his briefcase to the bar with him after explaining to her that he was afraid something might happen to it. Then when he sat at the bar, he had balanced the briefcase on his feet for a while, which meant that he had to keep reaching down to set it straight. Finally, he had gone back and given it to the checkroom girl and watched while she put it away on a high shelf. That had all happened some time before. Now he stood by my table and looked gloomily at me and said, "I don't mean to insult you." Then he said, "I want to know if you will have a drink with me." I said, "No, thank you. I'm waiting for somebody. I was sitting at a table for one." "You are waiting for somebody," he said, and he went back to his place at the bar. 10 or 15 minutes later, 2 ladies in small serviceable hats came in and sat down at the table next to me. They spoke French. One of them was French, or spoke like a Frenchwoman, and the other was speaking some French she had learned, using only whole sentences, and they both had loud, confident voices. The scholarly man got off his stool and came over to them. "I don't mean to insult you," he said. They stared up at him. He began to smile, and then he beamed at them. "Parlez-vous Berlitz?" he said. Monsieur Raymond, who had been gazing into the cash register, hurried over and took him by the elbow and began to tow him back to the bar. Monsieur Raymond said, "You don't know those people. Please, monsieur, s'il vous plaît." "I didn't mean to insult anybody," the man said, but he allowed himself to be placed back at the bar, where he sat guarding his drink with both elbows and looking resentful. The lesson to be learned from these 2 encounters is that if everybody in the city were sorted out and set going in the right direction, New York would soon become a very quiet place.
So the second story of that, it's just so, it's like these 2 encounters and it's so funny. And the second part too, it's like, I mean, Brennan, you're being a bit savage. I don't know, like she's clearly sitting at a table for one and she still says to this guy, "No, I'm waiting for someone," when she's clearly not. And it just gets me every time.
It's pretty sad. But like, I agree, but I think she was still rooting for him, you know, even though she was kind of like, "I don't really need to be the one to fulfill this dream of yours, but I still think you should be. Well, like she definitely is. She believes that he should be allowed to ask her. Like she's definitely not offended. I mean, she doesn't really want to hang out with him, but yeah, it's the way she describes him. He's like getting towed back to the bar and like allowing himself to be placed there and like guarding his drink. Like it's kind of like the man in the previous story where like everything is happening to him. This bumbling man is just like getting, he like can't catch a break and everybody's just like, you know, only doing things to him and like imposing their like values on him. And it's very tragic and also funny.
Yeah. And the descriptions are so rich. Like I love the scene of this man trying to balance his briefcase on his feet. It's just like, why are you doing that? But it makes me wonder, like, do you ever think that Brennan is hiding something from us and not giving us the full picture? Because to me, there's like in the first scene in that story, there seems to be like a disconnect between the interaction between the man and the woman and then the interaction when the waiter comes into play. It just seems like, I'm like, why is this waiter being so aggressive? Like the interaction doesn't sort of yield that type of aggression. And so I'm like, oh, is Brennan hiding anything from us?
Between the waiter and the woman, you mean?
Yes. Like it's so aggressive as compared to like the interaction between the man and the woman.
Yeah.
And so like what's warranting that aggression? And so I'm like, oh, is Brennan hiding something from us? Is she not giving us the full story here or what?
Like, that's really interesting. I kind of always just assume, I mean, like it is a really heated discussion and I don't feel like, yeah, when I read the scene, I don't feel like it's warranted. I kind of just assume that maybe in that social context, it was much more taboo to do what she did than it would seem to me if I was seeing it in my context. But it might be that she was in her sympathy for this woman sort of trying to just omit something that made the situation a lot more tense than we realize.
Reading Brennan, I often have a really tough time nailing down her tone. And I can't tell if she's being glib or funny, or if it's just the kind of a wry way that she has, or if there's some kind of antecedent, another writer that she's channeling in some ways. How would you describe her tonally?
Well, it's really interesting. Let me try and find it. She actually writes in like the author's note to one of the issues of The Long-Winded Lady. She describes herself as a traveler in residence. Which is an interesting phrase that we can come back to later. But she says, as a traveler, she is interested in what she sees, but she is not very curious, not even inquisitive. She is not a sightseer, never an explorer. And she's talking about the physical places that she's where she sets her scenes. But I think it also kind of applies to the style of like kind of not really inserting herself into these stories very much. I mean, some of the stories are about her, but even when she's describing herself, she kind of lets the movements and interactions sort of speak for themselves. Like she doesn't, I think Jess was saying earlier, that it's not really until the end of most of her essays that you kind of get any amount of opinion or analysis, which I just think is nice. Like she just sort of describes what's happening to people and what they're doing. And the comedy just sort of comes from that.
Yeah, you mentioned like how the end, we don't get judgment until the end. And I'm wondering then how we're supposed to perceive the character she describes in the story, because she does withhold judgment. But the fact of documentation would at least suggest these people are worth paying attention to. So I just, how are we supposed to perceive these people?
Well, I think she's really like kind of undiscriminating in what she seems to think is like worth looking at. I think what's kind of interesting about these essays is that some of them are kind of boring. Like, and I don't even mean that in a bad way. I mean, like sometimes you do come away from a certain encounter, not with nothing, but just with a sense of like, okay, well, this is really just one slice of what's going on. I mean, there's no ending here. Like, you know, most of what she's describing is just really doesn't have a beginning or an end. It's just like, it's almost like, you know, blurred photographs. And I think that's kind of, it's kind of cool that she's so, she doesn't seem to have like an antenna for who is interesting and who isn't. I think she actually says, yeah, in the same passage that I read, she says she's never felt the urge. She's just talking about herself in third person, but she says she's never felt the urge that drives people to investigate the city from top to bottom. And again, she is talking about, you know, like neighborhoods in the city, but I think that this also applies to people too. You know, she's not really seeking out a particular kind of person, a particular kind of interesting person. Like she's really, I think in one of her short stories, actually, it's maybe not in this book, but the character is telling his cat, do you know what a view is? A view is somewhere where we are not. And then the cat in the story like reflects on this idea and thinks to herself, like, I'm really just satisfied with where I am. Like, I don't really need a view. Which is really sweet. That's kind of, I think that kind of describes the narrator as well.
But I don't know. I find that oftentimes when I'm reading her, like you quoted her earlier talking about not being particularly curious or inquisitive, but I have trouble believing that in some ways because she goes to these kind of mundane places and is so astute in her observations about people that she seems so curious and so inquisitive in some ways. And so do you fully buy her kind of claim there that she's not, you know, that she's kind of an outsider and isn't really, intently observing things in the city? Or do you find that she is kind of belying her own intentions there a little bit?
No, I think it's definitely a good, narrative device to sort of establish credibility, as the I telling the story that like, to sort of say straight out that she doesn't really have any personal stakes. So yes, it is definitely a device that's used to her credit and to help her position as the narrator. But there's, I think there's some truth in it in that she, or at least what comes out of these essays is that she's not really looking for, I don't think she's really trying to draw anything out of them in order to make them worthwhile subjects. You know, like, because, well, you know, some, to say she's not curious is a little bit of a stretch, but she's definitely not demanding of like what happens. Like I would imagine that she witnessed, you know, many times as many scenes as she actually wrote about. Do you know what I mean? Like she went and sat in restaurants and like walked down the street and noticed so much more than she actually wrote and published. But I would think that she sort of had that same sort of accepting eye towards everything she saw, even if, you know, maybe her editors didn't think that it was worth writing about.
Right. I identify with Brennan in some ways because I'm someone who spends a lot of time by myself. I travel by myself a lot. I go to restaurants and bars by myself quite a bit. And I'm often doing the same thing that Brennan's doing, and that's people watching and making note of the somewhat embarrassing moments that other people are hoping go unnoticed. Like I'm assuming that the man with the briefcase would prefer to go unnoticed and no one observes the fact that he is in fact balancing a briefcase on his feet. But in some ways it's like, okay, on the one hand, she's kind of showing us that like these everyday moments are worth like describing and worth accounting and worth paying attention to. And then on the other hand, she's also doing this thing where what she is recording is what is often embarrassing and what people are embarrassed by. Oh, and so absolutely. I'm like wondering why is it those moments you're choosing to record? Is it like the gossip element attached to this or what? I don't know.
I mean, I would not want to be sitting at a restaurant where she was dining alone for sure. But I think that people are sort of, maybe people are just the most relatable or the most sympathetic when they're sort of, when they're exhibiting what she calls elsewhere, private failures. when they're just failing in these like small, low stakes ways. And it's very clear to someone who's paying attention what the hope was or what the plan was or and you kind of see that very quietly not go according to plan, and you see the reaction, you know, of someone who's realizing that it's not going to plan and sort of hoping no one notices. And I mean, the whole dynamic is, I think, what makes these characters so sympathetic in kind of a tragic way. And like, I wouldn't call her cruel. Some of her writing is a little bit darker and more cruel. Like her short stories in the Rose Garden. These ones I think are a little bit like a portrait of like people just trying to get by, you know? And like that just trying to get by-ness is what I find so sort of moving about these people who are, I don't know, like just not really at their best.
Yeah. I mean, and you can sense that in the way that she's perceiving these characters as well. Mm-hmm. But I still don't know if I would want to be a character in a Maeve Brennan essay. Because it means I would have done something embarrassing. At least like if we're taking this one, if we're thinking that the way she's documenting these people in Lost Overtures and what she's paying attention to, it's like, yeah, no, I don't want to be one of those people in her stories.
No, I think about this a lot. Like I don't know, if I'm like in public and like drop something and I can't decide whether or how to pick it up, or like I'm having a conversation that I'm trying to look like it's a really heated, ugly conversation. I'm trying to make it look pleasant for people who can see me but can't hear me. Like there's so many ways that you can be like witnessed and completely witnessed in a way where you have just no control over the narrative, I guess.
I'm wondering if we could go back to the end of the essay, that moment where she kind of swerves and says the lesson to be learned from these two encounters. Yeah. And where that move that she does in some of her pieces where she, you know, she's giving the kind of portrait and then she steps back and it almost feels like, you know, here's the case study. Here's my takeaway.
Yeah.
And, why do you think she does that? Why do you think she makes that move?
As a literary device, it's a little bit more in your face than the way she ends other essays, like the lesson to be learned here. But I think maybe she felt sort of strongly about like this right of people to sort of engage with each other in this like unsupervised way. She like one of her other essays is just like about her just like strolling down the street and like a million things happening to her, and how she kind of feels a sense of closeness with people because of like random circumstances that happen on the street. And it's like, it's very fleeting, but I think she felt very defensive of this opportunity that New York offered to have like, to experience like momentary intimacy with people, that this was kind of quashed in this story.
So you chose to pair your essay, "It's Okay to Talk to Me When I'm Trying to Read," with Brennan's. And this is very much an essay about Brennan's. And I'm just, what inspired you to write about her work and to write this essay more generally?
I kind of came to this just as like a personal value kind of in my adulthood. And like, I consciously like arrived at it and constructed it and like then just sort of have been really trying to follow it as like a tenet of my life, that I cannot object when people do exactly what happened in this story of hers. And I kind of had been slowly starting to settle on this idea even before I read this essay, which is why it meant so much to me when I read it. But I think I started feeling like in order to feel fully like absorbed into my environment, I have to kind of let things happen to me, is sort of what I arrived at. And being out and about in the city is not really just about doing things, but about things happening to me, which is not necessarily so much what's happening to Brennan in her essays, but what she's sort of watching for. She's like watching for things happening to people, not really people doing things that they can really, you know, that they're in control of. Like, she's not really documenting the cast of characters who have a ton of agency. And I think that that's just a very kind of core part of the urban experience. Trying to control what you do and what happens to you is like not, it does not really make for a very interesting or rich life in the city.
I'm curious how your New York is different from Brennan's. You know, in her essays, she's often going to Longchamp's, or I think one essay we read, it's steak de Paris. And I think last time I talked to you, we were talking about you going to Nowadays and reading in the backyard.
Yeah.
So how is your New York different than hers?
Yeah, it's funny. I it's so interesting to think of this, you know, in her 30s, single woman living alone, supporting herself with her like column at the New Yorker, and eating at like white tablecloth restaurants, like for every meal. I mean, I love it, but it's funny how like alien her material world is to me, even though, you know, the emotional world is so familiar. But I guess my version of what she does is that I sit by myself in bars and coffee shops a lot. And I work or I read, but very often I'm like with my laptop, like at this bar. Yeah. Some people do think. Sometimes it's a bar where people are sort of somewhere on the spectrum of like slightly annoyed because I'm sort of killing the vibe and just really fascinated and want to know what I'm doing and why I don't have any friends. Like, so there's always someone somewhere on the spectrum with reactions like that. I mean, we both have in common the fact that like, we don't really frequent places where it's totally taboo to sit by yourself, but I would just get responses more than it seems like she gets when she writes about herself sitting in restaurants.
Yeah. I've definitely gotten those responses as well.
When you're sitting
when I've been like, yeah, sitting at a bar with a beer, with my laptop, or even just like a book out. And it's like, it's either like, why are you working so late?
Or
why are you by yourself? Or why aren't you saving that for the library? And I'm like, can you sit alone? And so that's the point where I'm like, okay, well, I don't want to be interrupted in this moment. So but you seem to look at those interruptions more positively than maybe I do.
Yeah. Well, they're really not always pleasant. I went to this like random bar in this neighborhood I didn't know very well. I think it was Tribeca. And I had to like, I was like working on a deadline. I think I put this in a piece, but I was like working on an essay, and this guy asked if he could sit with me. And I was like, yeah, sure. Because I don't really allow myself to say no when someone asks me something like that. But then he like wouldn't leave me alone. And I kind of was like, this is a sort of delicate situation. Like we're here. Like, you're sitting with me, but you kind of also have to get it when you can see me working, like, you know, like it's a give and take. But he got really, really pissed when I said like, okay, I'm not talking to you anymore. Cause he was like, why did you let me sit with you then? And he was really hurt. I finally just had to tell him to get lost, and he called me a bitch, and it was just very like, he was genuinely like, I don't understand why women do this. Like, why do they let you talk to them and then tell you to fuck off? And I kind of was like, I don't know, man. It sucks. I'm sorry.
But it's also like, dude, read the social situation in which you're in.
Yeah.
Like,
no,
read,
totally.
Read the moment.
Yeah. No, it is. It is. It's, I mean, there's always some, yeah, there always has to be some give and take when you kind of put yourself in like a public place where you can be observed and like assessed for how open you are, whether you necessarily agree with that assessment or not. I think we talked about this last time, but Zach brought up Nowadays, like where I go, or like during summer, I used to go to sit in like the hammocks in the backyard. Nowadays it's a club, but it's open in the daytime and it has a bar in the backyard. And I like going there with my, or even at night, like you can go sit in like these outdoor at these picnic benches or in these hammocks and you can read. And it's kind of a weird place to be by yourself because it's where people go to party. But it's funny because this doesn't happen in the space, in the part of the space that I am usually in, which is in the more chilled backyard. But it's funny because in the indoor part of nowadays, like in the club, there is sort of like a version of the head waiters in these restaurants, kind of like laying the rules of what sort of contact is allowed in these spaces, because they're like rave spaces. And it's funny to sort of compare that sort of, not policing, but management of the social situation to the management of the social situation that was happening at these restaurants, where these waiters were like, you can't talk to people you don't know, just because whatever, it's inappropriate. It might not be consensual. Like it doesn't really paint a good look. It's unseemly. That sort of surveillance is still very much with us. Mm. And this is not to say that there's no such thing as, you know, like you can definitely cross the line. Like when I mean, in the essay that I wrote in like defense of letting people interrupt me, like I was obviously not really considering more actively threatening types of behavior, which are very real as well, that we don't maybe talk about enough. But I was just sort of trying to, explore the moments where the situation is not that clear about whether a certain type of interaction is actively unwanted, or whether it's actively disturbing, or whether it's disruptive to the general experience in a good way or a bad way, or neither. Like there's many shades in between those two, in between the positive and the negative, that I think is like endlessly fascinating.
In the past couple of years, I feel like I've seen Maeve Brennan's name pop up in a lot of places. I have friends who've been reading her. She shows up in one of Brian Dillon's books.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I'm curious why you think she has kind of resonated with a lot of people recently, and what about her work kind of comports with the present age?
Yeah, I think her like homelessness is a big part of why she's so just eternally relatable. Like this, like her flaneur's identity was so tied up with roving New York and kind of looking for a spiritual home and never really feeling at home anywhere. I mean, the image of her kind of later in life, you know, only just moving from hotel to hotel. She has an essay or a story where she describes going to stay at a friend's house and having his furniture look at her judgingly and say, we'll never belong to you. I think her like, and she moved around, but she always sort of kept coming back and like maybe not really finding what she was looking for. She has a really sad quote about like how New York never really adopts you, but also never really lets you go. Wait, let me try. New York does nothing for those of us who are inclined to love her, except implant in our hearts a homesickness that baffles us until we go away from her, and then we realize why we are restless. At home or away, we are homesick for New York. It's really sad. I mean, it's really sad. I don't think it's sad in a, I mean, it's beautiful, but it's really, I think she really got at this like unknowability of, I don't know, the idea of home. That's sort of relatable to a lot of people in New York. I mean, I know that sounds kind of cliche, but I really think that there's like an important truth in like the way she talked about being a traveler in residence and like feeling unrooted.
Well, Apoorva, thank you so much for joining us. It was really fun to talk to you about Maeve Brennan and to get a chance to read her work. And like I said before we started recording, I really want to read more of her because I really liked what we read for today.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, everyone, for joining us for this episode of Selected Essays. We'd like to thank John Travascus for editing the podcast and Meg Duffy of Hand Habits for contributing the original music. As always, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and please subscribe to The Point. There's a discount code for listeners in the show notes. If you have questions, comments, or anything else, send an email to selectedessays@thepointmag.com. We'd love to hear from you. Until next time, listeners.